This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm Evan Wasuka, and welcome to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia, where we'll take a look at the big stories from across the region over the past week. Coming up, PNG's Prime Minister attempts to reassure the public over its new security treaty with the United States. Fiji's biggest political party is suspended from Parliament for failing to submit its audited report. And National Geographic launches a new expedition into the Pacific. We'll have more on those stories coming up. But first, the Prime Minister of Papua New Guinea, James Marape, has moved to reassure his people that a new security pact with the United States will not undermine their country's sovereignty or security. Mr. Marape's comments follow a leaked draft of the Defence Cooperation Agreement, which led to plenty of debate and criticism before, during and after the signing ceremony in Port Moresby, where the US was represented by the Secretary of State, Antony Blinken. But as Liam Fox reports, a former commander of the PNG Defence Force is among those raising concerns about the new security deal.
A day after his defence minister inked the Defence Cooperation Agreement with Secretary Blinken, Prime Minister James Marape was on the front foot going on talkback radio to clear up what he called misinformation.
A lot of misinformation will be spin in the public domain. I can understand the concern equally for their country. Some in the midst political opportunities spinning to their advantage.
That misinformation, as Mr. Marape would call it, ramped up last week after a leaked draft of the agreement suggested the US wanted to access PNG military facilities and raise the prospect of legal immunity for US personnel if they broke PNG laws. Jerry Singerok, former commander of the PNG Defence Force, is among those worried about what the long-term implications of the agreement could be.
I hope that the Defence Cooperation Program with USA is not a prelude to justify the presence of US and Australia in Manus Naval Base.
He says the PNGDF needs all the help it can get, but he's concerned about the lack of information released to the public before the agreement was signed.
Well, US and Papua New Guinea have the freedom to develop this bilateral relations through Defence Cooperation Program. I still believe that the public needs to be consulted because of the global tensions and the superpower rivalry in the Pacific, because Pacific is the last frontier.
Another to voice concerns is Mr. Marape's predecessor in the Prime Minister's office, Peter O'Neill.
I think that security arrangements such as that does not comply with our constitution and our laws. It requires our parliament and our people to have a bit more scrutiny over it. And there's a lot of secrecy around this agreement.
Like the rest of the public, Mr. O'Neill has not seen the full text of the agreement, but he says with increasing competition between the US and China, it's not the time to be strengthening military ties with America.
The talk that is going on is it's reaching dangerous levels. And the PNG is now caught in between in that conversation.
Instead, he says the government should focus on deepening economic, not military engagement with both China and the US.
They do have a lot to offer in that aspect. And you know, Papua New Guinea has got many, many challenges. And I believe that by having such a relationship in terms of economy will create more opportunities for our people.
Prime Minister Marape, though, says the agreement will bolster, not undermine, PNG security.
It is in my interest and our nation's interest to build a military that is stronger, that is better, to face challenges of our sovereignty going forward into the future. I watch with sadness our military being eroded in the last 40 years.
On the concerns around secrecy and the lack of public consultation, Mr. Marape says people will have access to the agreement. He wants full transparency.
This is a public document. I've made commitment that the country will be totally exposed to what was agreed upon.
Interested citizens might have to wait a little longer, though, to read the agreement. People who went along to an information session hosted by the Defence Ministry yesterday were told they'd have to wait until it's presented to Parliament at the next sitting in 2 weeks' time.
Liam Fox reporting. Now it's time to hear about the big stories from across the Pacific this week. And we're joined by Pacific Beat presenter Priyanka Srinivasan. Good morning, Priyanka. Let's start with another treaty that the United States has signed in the Pacific, not with PNG, but with some Micronesian countries. What do we know about these treaties?
Yes. So, Evan, these treaties are those United States Compact of Free Association agreements. Now, the two that were signed this week was with the Federated States of Micronesia and the United States, and then another one between Palau and the United States. So, as you perhaps know, these Compact of Free Associations, or COFA agreements, have existed for a couple of decades now, from around the 1980s. And basically, they grant the U.S. access to COFA nations, to these Pacific nations, territorial waters. And it also means that the United States will retain some responsibility for the defense and sort of security of these countries as well. In return for this, these Pacific countries who are part of COFA, they get substantial economic assistance. Now, these agreements were due to expire very soon, some this year, some the following year. And, of course, there was that extra pressure from the rise of China and the United States' desire to counter China's rise in the region to really sign these deals and make sure the United States could still have that, you know, defensive territorial sort of influence on, let's say, on some of these COFA nations. The negotiations did stretch as a result, not only of that, but also due in part to some complications around the United States' legacy of nuclear testing in the Pacific in the 1940s and 1950s. There were calls particularly for a formal apology to Marshall Islands, where a lot of these tests happened, and also for some compensation to happen from the United States to Marshall Islands, which we understand led in part to these negotiations being a bit stretched. As for Palau and the Federated States of Micronesia, those two agreements have been signed. Details are yet to be exactly released, but we do know there's been a substantial economic boost from the U.S. given to both Palau and Micronesia. We heard from Palau's president, Sarungal Whips Jr., this week after the signing of those deals on the sidelines of that meeting in Papua New Guinea. And he says the new deal helps the country overcome a few economic challenges.
Well, first, economic coercion by our neighbors by reducing the number of visitors coming to Palau, and then later getting hit by COVID. So in the end, we really got 30% of our economy was gone. We went into debt. And so the compact also addresses the huge debt burden that we have in helping us pay that down. So a combination of those really puts Palau on a path to economic resilience. So in the end, the agreement really puts the United States, it's a win for the United States and also a win for Palau. And I think that's the way agreement should be. They should be a win for both parties.
And that's Palau's president, Sarungal Whips Jr., one of the two countries that has signed that Compact of Free Association with the United States. Now, Priyanka, let's head over to Timor-Leste, where the election results have all been tallied, and who came out on top?
Well, Evan, it looks like the country's first president and independence leader, Xanana Gusmão, will likely become the next prime minister now. Now, it's not a direct path there, because it looks like Gusmão's opposition, a CNRT party, didn't quite get the majority of their votes. We understand that the final tally is around 42%, just under that, in fact. So that means, since he didn't receive the majority of votes, he'll have to form a coalition to lead the government. And that's likely to happen with the Democratic Party there in Timor-Leste. And they will bring in a whole new government because, as I mentioned, CNRT is, or at least was, in opposition and is now looking to take over the government after this recent election that happened last week on Sunday. Now, this election dealt quite a decisive blow to the incumbent Frelimo Party. They were in government, and the leader of Fretilin, Mari Alkatiri, is considered quite a strong rival of Guzmão. But Fretilin only achieved a quarter of the vote, despite being the incumbents, and that, you know, poor result as a result of this election has led to talks of a change of leadership inside Fretilin. People are saying that the government, the party needs a sort of new people, new blood to make over and sort of make sure that they're appealing to voters and this result doesn't happen again. Because as for the issues that voters were going to, it seemed to be a lot of young people, the younger demographic leading this change in government. We spoke to some people on the ground there and they said some voters were frustrated at the response to the COVID pandemic, leading them to want a change in government. There were also strong concerns around unemployment and the high rates of unemployment in Timor-Leste, and also some ongoing issues about the economy, which led voters to want a change, which they did see in electing a new prime minister, it seems. We're likely to happen with this coalition under Guzmão.
Now, finally, Priyanka, let's head over to Guam, where authorities seem to be picking up the pieces after a super typhoon hit. What's been the damage there?
Yes, that's right, Evan. So this Category 4 typhoon, Mawa, left quite a wreckage in Guam over the last few days. So the typhoon passed through Guam on Thursday night. That led to gale force winds hitting the country. You know, a night of lightning, very heavy rainfall. Luckily, we're hearing that there have been no casualties or injuries as a result of that typhoon. But there has been power and water access lost in some areas, particularly the hardest hit areas. Local reports have said that health systems in some of those hardest hit areas like Rota have suffered the loss of power, loss of water, but they have recently been electrified and some water access has been provided. We're hearing, you know, the latest on the ground. Those are obviously the priorities to get the hospitals back up and running. Unfortunately, they've found some water leaks in some of the pipes going into the hospitals, local reports were saying. And so, yes, there's still a little bit of recovery effort to identify those leaks and make sure particularly those important health centers have access to power and water that they need as a result after this typhoon. We're also hearing that trees have been ripped out, cars have been flipped over, windows blown out in some buildings. Some buildings have also crumbled, especially the ones that weren't reinforced to deal with these strong winds from the powerful typhoon. And we're also hearing this is the strongest typhoon in decades to hit Guam. As a result of this typhoon, the Biden administration, the United States, has announced emergency assistance. We understand some defense personnel and air carriers have been sent to Guam to provide some relief. We also heard from Landon Eidlett. He's the National Weather Service's warning coordination meteorologist there in Guam. And he says the cleanup will take quite some time.
Yeah, we were looking at this being possibly one of the worst typhoons on record. That would have been parallel to Typhoon Karen back in the 1960s. Luckily, this one, it weakened just a little bit upon approach to Guam. But it was one of the worst typhoons we've had in 20 years since 2002 with Typhoon Pangsawa. This one packed a punch, but what was most noticeable about this that people were terrified about was it was relentless. It continued for hours. Usually these storms, they come, they thrash, and they move offshore. This one lasted for 6 to 8 hours across much of Guam.
Landon Eidlett from Guam's National Weather Service, and that wrap-up from Priyanka Srinivasan from Pacific Beat. National Geographic has launched an unprecedented 5-year expedition into the Pacific. Using cutting-edge technology, the Pristine Seas Expedition has promised the discovery of new species and hopes to create marine protected areas. And the work may also have implications for the future of contentious deep-sea mining proposals within the Pacific. Cooper Williams with this report.
The Pacific is home to some of the world's deepest oceans and last pristine coral reefs, but much of it remains a mystery to science. 5-year National Geographic exploration called Pristine Seas wants to uncover the unknown by studying everything from microscopic algae to the largest sharks and whales.
So we're embarking on this epic journey that's unprecedented in scope and scale. Some of these places that we've been have little to no data on them at all. We're always looking for new species. A lot of the deep sea has never been explored in many of these places.
Alan Friedlander is the chief scientist for the National Geographic Pristine Seas Expedition. He says it is the first of its kind.
Starting next week, we'll travel to the Southern Hawaiian Islands of Kiribati, followed by Tongariro in the Cook Islands, then on to Niue between Tonga and the Cooks, then on to the Marshall Islands later on in the year, and finishing up at the Federated States of Micronesia.
But why the Pacific? Mr. Friedlander says there's lots to learn from its marine environments to its history.
There's a lot of lessons to be learned there about our ability to adapt globally in the Anthropocene. Pacific Islanders pretty much invented marine conservation. Many of the strategies we have today, closed areas, closed seasons, size limits, all those, limited entry, they were all developed millennia ago by people of Oceania.
Along the way, the expedition hopes to partner with Pacific governments, NGOs, and scientists and use the knowledge gained to create marine protected areas. Henrique Sala is the founder of Pristine Seas and says the expedition will use cutting-edge technology specifically designed for deep-sea exploration.
We have these cameras developed at the National Geographic Exploration Lab that allows us to go as deep as 6,000 meters. And they go down, they are filming there for hours, and then they come back to the surface. So that's a pretty cheap way to explore the deep sea, of which we know very, very, very little. Every time we go to an area and drop our cameras or go down with a submarine where there have been no scientific studies before, every single time we find new species, every single time we discover things.
One of the issues the expedition will investigate is deep sea mining, a contentious issue in the region. Mr. Sala says the special cameras will be used to get a better picture of life at the depths where mining would take place.
That deep sea mining is a serious threat to that rich and fragile marine life of the depths. And we believe that we should know more. The world should not rush to mine the deep sea until we know enough about this part of the world, the most unknown part of the world, the last frontier, but also until we know that the mining operations would be actually harmless to the marine environment, which right now they don't seem to be. There are countries like France and Costa Rica and others that are asking for a moratorium of deep sea mining until we know more, until we can make sure that any operation will not harm marine life that has been there for many thousands of years and that can be destroyed with a single pass of a big machine.
Palau's Minister for Environment, Stephen Victor, shares those concerns. He welcomes the expedition and hopes it will put a halt to deep sea mining in the Pacific.
We hope that this expedition continue to also provide a glimpse into the depth of the ocean that oftentimes we have very little appreciation to because we don't know what's there. And we tend to believe that what we do in the depth of the ocean, we can minimize the impact. But if I have said in other dialogue that Palau strongly believe in banning and putting a moratorium on deep sea mining because there's not enough that we know about what's in the deep sea and the impact of deep sea mining would have on our already impacted marine ecosystem.
Minister Victor would like to see real benefits for Pacific communities that come from this expedition. He says if marine protected areas are established, they'll need to be well thought out.
How do we balance the socioeconomic as well as the biodiversity needs of the people who are dependent on these resources? And therefore, that we ensure that the strategies and the protection we put in place are long-lasting and durable.
For Pacific communities, this expedition comes at a time of great uncertainty, with the impacts of climate change becoming increasingly apparent. Minister Victor says the future of ocean sustainability is a global responsibility.
We are an ocean people and culture. The main engines of our economy are marine-based tourism and fisheries. We as Pacific Islanders have taken that responsibility to take care of the ocean, and we call on the rest of the world to share that responsibility with us. And I hope that this global expedition will shine more light on that and will get more ocean advocates and more nations to continue to see the important role that the ocean has in helping mitigate impact of climate change.
For Chief Scientist Mr. Friedlander, the expedition comes at a critical time, and he believes that the Pacific may hold lessons for the future and climate mitigation and adaptation.
The timing of this work couldn't be more urgent, given the growing threats that are currently facing our planet. This is a unique opportunity to support local conservation efforts in Palau and elsewhere in a region with some of the last pristine coral reef left on Earth, and also a region with a long history of marine conservation. So really, it's about, you know, learning from the past with the hope of helping to preserve the future.
The Pristine Seas Expedition is due to wrap up in 2028. National Geographic says it will be publishing peer-reviewed scientific studies throughout the expedition, and cinematographers will be documenting their discoveries.
Cooper Williams reporting. The main opposition party in Fiji remains barred from parliament. 24 MPs from Fiji First, which ruled the country from 2014 until late last year, have been told they can't take their seats again until the Electoral Commission receives audited financial reports from the party. Four other parties have also been suspended pending the delivery of their reports. But as the largest single party in the current parliament, is the suspension of Fiji First actually justified? Priyanka Srinivasan put the question to John Frankel, Professor of Comparative Politics at Victoria University in Wellington.
It's a sign of the degree to which the former ruling party, Fiji First, has been hoisted on its own petard, because it was Fiji First that passed all these draconian party regulations in the three acts of continuous that introduce all these fines and strict rules about signatures required across the country, about audited accounts, about statements, about sources of income. And I think it's hardly surprising that even without direct intervention, it's hardly surprising that the supervisor of elections uses these against the opposition parties and against three small parties that gain no seats in parliament, but is more reluctant to use these laws against the ruling parties, the parties in coalition and government. That's one reason why I think these laws are not necessarily that good an idea. Mm-hmm. It's always going to be more likely that civil servants find it very difficult to act in a neutral way. Even when they're not overtly partisan, the incentives are all to use these laws to punish the opposition, but not to punish the governing parties.
Yeah, it's very interesting. And it's interesting that you say, hoisted by their own petard. It is the Fiji First party, when they were in rule, that brought in some of these regulations. But meanwhile, Ayaside Kayum, the former Attorney General, who is, of course, part of Fiji First, has described this as grossly unfair and biased. You mentioned there that it's the regulations that, I guess, the supervisor of elections is following to the T. Could we possibly see these reversed? Is there a push for that happening?
The regulations reversed? Well, yes, she has talked about reviews of the Electoral Act, but this is the Political Parties Act. There are three major acts that govern the electoral registration, and all of them really need reviewing. Let's remember, this is the acting supervisor of elections, Anna Matailiwa, and she's replaced Mohamed Sanim, who was the substantive supervisor of elections and who was a close ally of the Fiji First government. So over the 2014 to 2018 and 2018 to 22 parliaments, it was Sanim who used these regulations almost entirely against the opposition parties, not against the ruling Fiji First Party. So when Ayaside Kayum complains, he's complaining really about his own regulations, or regulations that were enforced by his close ally, and regulations that he had few qualms about when they were used to try and discredit the opposition. I think also, it's also a sign of the fact that Fiji First is changing a lot as a political party. It used to be kind of omnipresent. It would make sure it had all its accounts audited regularly every year. It played everything by the book. But since it's come out of government in December,
it no longer has those roots in the state. It no longer has access to the same resources.
Professor John Frankel from Victoria University in Wellington and a longtime analyst of the political scene in the Pacific. He was talking there to Priyanka Srinivasan. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Review for this week. I'm Evan Wasuka. Do join us again at the same time next week for more news and views from across the Pacific.